Peter Clark formerly taught modern history at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of many acclaimed books. We are talking about his brand new book, Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist. My name is C.S. Song. Well, public works spending by government relies often on borrowing. The government has to borrow that money in order to provide it as a stimulus to the economy. How did Keynes respond to the argument that borrowing such money to pour into public works creates a debt, the burden of which the next generation must carry?
Keynes responded to that argument by saying that the next generation would be much better able to carry that debt if the economy, meanwhile, had grown and was that much stronger and was providing everyone in that generation with higher incomes as a result. And indeed, if one looks at the historical experience here, my own work has been mainly on the levels of British public debt, but much the same would apply in the US as well. If you look at the extraordinary high levels of public debt that were incurred in Britain at the end of both world wars, what you see at the end of the First World War is that government tried to pay off the debt by balancing the budget and got almost nowhere. By 1938-39, when the whole story starts all over again, Britain gets involved in another war. Even more debt is piled up, though not proportionately so much in the Second World War. You get a big debt in 1945 as a proportion of gross domestic product, GDP. What do you find? Government's not obsessed after Keynes with simply balancing the budget, but with growing the economy. And the level of debt is paid off, I don't say quickly, I don't say entirely easily, but within 40 years, the historic level of debt has gone right down, not because the amount of debt has been reduced in money terms, but because the GDP, the growth of the economy itself, has been so enormously increased. So the real test for a stimulus is, does it put us back on a path to growth where it will increase GDP in itself?
Keynes had some strong ideas about capitalism as a system. At one point, he wrote that capitalism in itself, quote, is in many ways extremely objectionable. What did he mean by this? And does this mean that Keynes wanted capitalism to be replaced?
He thought it was extremely objectionable, really, on grounds of social justice. He wasn't a rigid egalitarian, but he thought that the system that he saw around him, which left millions of his fellow Britons impoverished, was something. We ought to be able to do better than that, is what he's saying. And part of his argument for stimulus measures and all the rest of it is that, at any rate, you must try and create as much prosperity as you can. But he does actually, he thinks the market is an excellent instrument and must be made to work as well as possible. He thought it was an excellent servant, but shouldn't become the master of the economy, that we shouldn't have any false reverence for it. And he certainly, when he looked at alternative socialist models, especially the Soviet example, he found that repellent on a number of grounds. Intellectually objectionable, morally repugnant, politically unappealing. So he certainly doesn't see a socialist alternative to capitalism. He wants to save capitalism, even if the capitalists at times won't let him do so.
What did Keynes think of the ideas of Karl Marx?
Not much. He didn't think much of Marx. He argued for years with George Bernard Shaw, who in the 1880s, just when Keynes was just a toddler, had become enthused with the ideas of Marx. Keynes keeps telling Shaw, I don't see what you see in Marx. There's nothing very interesting here. There's nothing that appeals to me. He didn't think much of Marx in a technical sense as an economist, and at the time, in the 1930s, it was Marx the Economist, who was most often cited, Marx makes almost no appeal to Keynes.
You write in your book, Keynes, the thrilling rhetoric of the young Marx, stressing human volition in remaking society, was little known until the early writings were rediscovered and widely disseminated in the 1960s. So, of course, Keynes, who died in 1946, obviously didn't have access to those writings.
That's right. To someone of my generation, born in the 1940s, many young people in the 60s were suddenly discovering a Marx who'd been very little known, a Marx who's a humanist, who seems quite exciting in writing about human values. We can't know whether that kind of Marx would have appealed to Keynes any more strongly than what he knew about. But what he knew about was Marx as a rather rigid example of late classical economics, but with a determinist twist towards the destruction of the system. And that Marx had very little appeal for Keynes.
John Maynard Keynes' name is, of course, often associated with the New Deal in the U.S. What did Keynes think of FDR, and to what extent did Roosevelt use Keynesian ideas in conceptualizing and implementing New Deal programs?
Let me deal with the second part of that first. The influence of Keynes upon Roosevelt is a question that's been debated for 60 or 70 years. Republican critics of the New Deal often pointed to Keynes as the bad fairy here, whose ideas had taken the country in an unappealing direction in a slide to socialism, and they wanted to claim their country back. But the more we investigate this historically, the more difficult it is to find much real input from Keynesian ideas into the New Deal, at any rate before about 1938, which is pretty late on in the New Deal. But then there's another question: what did Keynes think of Roosevelt from an extraordinary early point, really more or less immediately after Roosevelt's inauguration in March 1933. Keynes seizes on Roosevelt almost as the hope of the world, or the hope of liberals throughout the world. And it does occur to me that the influence of Roosevelt on Keynes, to turn the question the other way around, is an interesting subject, because when Roosevelt proclaims in that thrilling voice of his that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, he's highlighting the importance of confidence in the economy. And it's from almost exactly that moment that we can find in Keynes's writings an increasing emphasis on the importance of confidence and psychological factors in making the economy go round.
I'm CS. My guest is Peter Clark. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C., although he lives in Suffolk, England, and Pender Island, British Columbia. He is a former professor of modern history at the University of Cambridge, the author of books like The Keynesian Revolution and Its Economic Consequences, and Hope and Glory, Britain, 1900 to 2000, which is the final volume of the Penguin History of Britain. We're talking about his brand new book, Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist. We have a link on our website, againstthegrain.org, to Peter's new book. You argue in your book, and I think it's really incontestable, that after Keynes's death, a certain set of policies came to be known as Keynesianism in the U.S. that wasn't necessarily faithful to what Keynes actually argued. Tell us what American Keynesianism came to signify.
What's distinctive about American Keynesianism is partly a result of the personal influence of Keynes's biggest champion in the United States, Alvin Hansen, who was a professor of economics at Harvard, particularly influential position there, a late convert to Keynes's ideas, not until after 1936, when the general theory had been published. But once he was converted, he proclaimed this message, but he gave it his own twist, because what Hansen believed in was an idea that was currently fashionable, and he made it fashionable. He talked about secular stagnation, as though once the frontier had been closed, once mass immigration had ceased, a capitalist economy like that in the United States was likely to suffer stagnation and ever-increasing amounts of government spending. Permanent government deficits might be necessary in order to pull the economy out of this. Now, if you put that mixture of ideas in conjunction with the events of the Second World War, when indeed, for externally driven reasons, government spending did increase and deficits were opened up and full employment was maintained, you get the conditions, I think, where after the war, a sort of Keynesianism was established in American terms, which focused almost exclusively on fiscal issues, on the budget deficit, and which was linked first in a benign way with the growth of the economy after the Second World War. But likewise, this link with deficits, as though deficits was the main point of Keynes's message, eventually, I think, served to bring down the Keynesian model in the 1970s and 80s, when this seemed a very dubious way of running the economy. And indeed, there was much wrong with it, but many of the things that were wrong with it weren't attributable to the historical John Maynard Keynes.
Did Keynes advocate for budget deficits in his writings?
Keynes's position on deficits is really quite subtle. Most of the time, he says, a balanced budget is a very good thing. Fiscal orthodoxy, in that sense, is a very good thing. And certainly when you're in a boom, government ought to be running a surplus. But, he says, when you go into a recession, when you face the threat of depression and deflation, it will only intensify it if government, too, tightens its belt. So government should permit the deficit to open out, as it will, because tax revenues are dropping and government shouldn't restrain its own spending under those conditions. That's really Keynes's doctrine on the deficit.
We saw with the ascendancy of Reagan in the U.S. an argument made that tax cuts would spur investment. What did Keynes think of that argument?
Keynes thought that tax cuts might be helpful, but he said there was no certainty they would be. If you were putting money into the pockets of wealthy potential investors at a time when they'd lost confidence in investment, then the tax cuts wouldn't achieve the effect of increasing investment overall. He has many arguments with some of his younger followers about this in the 1940s, in the years just before his death. People like James Mead, later a Nobel laureate, who are in favor of regulating the economy by tax cuts or manipulating other fiscal payments when a recession threatened. But Keynes argues with Mead. He says, no, it would be much better if government invested in the infrastructure under these conditions. It may seem quicker and easier to put through the tax cut, but there can be no guarantee that it will actually have a stimulative effect.
Peter Clark is our guest. We're talking about his new book, Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist. You mentioned that it's not entirely accurate to associate Keynes with budget deficits. What about linking him with tax and spend policies, which seems to be, that linkage seems to be done quite a bit?
Talking about Keynes as a tax and spend advocate, of course, is meant generally in a derogatory sense. But, you know, if we're just concerned with balancing the budget and having a sound budgetary position, tax and spend policies can make for a sound financial policy. The problem would be if you spend without doing the taxing. And in fact, there's a very big gap, I think, here between the rhetoric And the reality, if you look at the Reagan era in the United States, there was no one by that stage firmer against Keynesian policies and tax and spend than Reagan, but the budgets that he actually presided over involved a lot more spending than they did taxing. That's why the deficits started to open out in that period. So tax and spend is much more a political slogan, a political football, if you like, than an accurate description, I think, of anybody's economic proposals.
Well, I guess any discussion of John Maynard Keynes wouldn't be complete without some discussion of his role in the establishment of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in 1944 at Bretton Woods. What can you share with us?
At the end of the Second World War, Keynes was looking forward to building for peace, but his perspective had undoubtedly been broadened by the experience not only of the war but of the Depression too. During the Depression, Keynes had sometimes toyed with the idea that protection, although in general a bad idea, might be a necessary expedient for a country like Britain. But when he looked back on the 1930s, like many other people, he saw that the beggar my neighbor policies of the 1930s hadn't benefited anybody, any particular country individually. So that's one impetus for him pitching his ideas in an international context much more firmly. And then, too, he'd spent many years during the war in detailed negotiations with the Americans, and although his primary purpose had been to fund the British war effort, he'd also established an affinity of views with those in the U.S. Treasury and elsewhere with whom he negotiated. And the idea that Britain and America in particular could work together to establish a better framework for international financial policy comes to dominate his thinking here. What's achieved at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 is not really a Keynesian blueprint here. He'd been negotiating with Harry Dexter White, representing the U.S. Treasury, as his main antagonist, though in the end his main partner in the negotiations. There was a White plan and there was a Keynes plan for doing these things. But since American preponderance was so enormous at that point, it was obvious that the White plan was going to be the basis for doing things, not the Keynes plan. But Keynes mucked in with White and helped create the institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, that would underpin much freer patterns of international trade after the war. And he played a very significant part in bringing this about.
Let's conclude this way. What did the great economic meltdown that began in 2008, what did that tell us about the validity of the belief that unrestrained market forces could keep the economy humming and cure whatever ailed it?
I think the relevance of Keynes in the meltdown that came in 2008 is really twofold. People turned first to Keynes after the meltdown because he was the man who threw them an economic life belt, who said, here is the way to get out of this kind of mess, the sort of stimulus proposals with which we're familiar. But at a deeper level, at a level of theory and of understanding what had happened, he was also the man who explained why the market can fail in this way, why it's not infallible, because he had given us a model of the economy in which he showed that there may be situations where individual rationality may not be enough to keep the economy humming here, where we may all be trapped into cycles of behavior that we can't escape from, which are cumulatively irrational. As one of the Wall Street bankers said at one point, as long as the music's playing, you have to go on playing this game, as though it was a sort of mad, frenetic game of musical chairs. And Keynes, I think, by his focus on the aggregate outcomes here, shows how the system as a whole may produce an irrational result, even when all the individual participants are observing what seem to them to be rational or at least inescapable strategies personally.
Peter Clark, author of books like Hope and Glory, Britain 1900 to 2000, and The Last Thousand Days of the British Empire. We've been talking about his new book, Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist, published by Bloomsbury Press. We have a link to it on againstthegrain.org. Peter Clark, thanks so much for being so generous with your time today.
Thank you very much.
Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song.